Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Michael Mastrangelo, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing the Bighorn River. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Michael a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Michael Mastrangelo about fly fishing the Bighorn River. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, they cover subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit their website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Michael, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you'll have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Michael's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a one-year subscription to Hook Now, an online e-zine published by Dave Hughes, Rick Hafley, and Skip Morris. If you want to learn more about it, it's at www.hookednow.com. So to win this subscription to Hook Now, here's how you can do it. You have to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, type fast, and maybe you'll win that subscription to Hook Now. Tonight, our guest is Michael Mastrangelo. Michael has been fishing the Bighorn River since 1985 and is the owner outfitter for the Fort Smith Fly Shop and Cabins / Bighorn River Guides since 1997. Michael began fishing as a boy in Boston, Massachusetts, with his uncle and cousins. They fish the ocean as well as lakes and streams around New England. He's been a fly tire for many years. Some of his creations include the Worminator, Trout Candy, and Indian Headdress. Michael was the past president of Bighorn River Alliance for 5 years, a nonprofit organization designed to preserve, protect, and enhance the Bighorn River. In the off-season, Michael spends time with other anglers at fishing shows and clubs presenting angling tips, tricks, and techniques for fishing the Bighorn. He has spoken throughout the Rocky Mountain states as well as in New England. Michael has also published an article on fishing the Bighorn in High Country Angler magazine. He taped several episodes for the TV show Columbia Country, as well as many local television and newspaper articles relating to the Bighorn River. Since 2009, Bighorn River Guides has been offering a professional guide school with Michael and Chad Becker as instructors. The school is not only for people who want to become guides, but for people who want to take a quantum leap in their fishing ability. In 2012, they started working with the Veterans Administration and are the only school in Montana eligible to accept GI Bill VA education benefits. Longtime clients call Michael the Trout Father. Michael, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger. How are you tonight?
Good, good. Well, good to have you. And I know you're fresh off the river and trying to cool down. You said it was pretty hot out there today, huh?
About 103, 104, pretty warm.
That's pretty warm, all right. It's anybody's
brutal,
book.
But when you're on the water, it's not quite that hot because you get a little breeze off the river and it cools you a little bit, but it's still warm.
Yeah, it's always nicer to be on the water than off the water, that's for sure. Okay, so lots of questions from our audience about the Bighorn. I have to say up front that it's one of my favorite rivers to fish. It was the first river I ever went down in a drift boat fly fishing, so it's got a lot of good memories, and that was with my father, and so it's got a lot of good memories going back many, many years. But I'm sure we do have an international audience, and there's a lot of people that may not know where the Bighorn is. So first of all, give us a little geography lesson here, Michael, and tell us where it is in the world.
Okay. There are actually two Bighorns. There's, part of it is in Wyoming, and the more famous place is in Montana. It starts as the Wind River, in just in the Wind River range of western, kind of northwestern Wyoming. And eventually it winds its way through central Wyoming, and it flows north and becomes the Bighorn. And once it kind of is a 72-mile-long lake behind the main dam here, Yellowtail Dam, and it extends from Montana down into Lovell, Wyoming. And I always call it, well, that's the real Bighorn, the beginning of that, in Fort Smith, Montana. So it's south-central Montana, probably about 45, 50 miles southeast of Billings as the crow flies, but more about 95 miles on roadways, as you have to go around the reservation. So it's right in south-central Montana, not far from the Wyoming border.
So describe the river itself, starting with basically the area that we know best as fly fishers, starting at Fort Smith. And kind of give us a tour, you know, like from the top down, walk us from put-ins and tell us about takeouts and what the river's like.
Okay. It is a tailwater river, meaning it is dam controlled. This one is a little different than some because you have two dams, a re-regulation dam. So when they do make power at the main dam, there's an afterbay lake in between the two dams, so they don't have to really put that much flow into the river. Some places you go, you hear a horn, and you have to get out because it's going to be really deep and quick. Here you don't. So the top of the river is called the first access. Below the re-regulation dam is called the afterbay boat access. And there are several on the river. It goes from afterbay, the next one is 3 mile, then you have Bighorn access, which is about 13 miles. And then you go down to Mallard's Landing and then Two Leggins. The river continues on below that, but pretty much it's 32 miles of fishing from the afterbay dam. The fish count is a little less per mile as you get down further, and the water clarity is usually not as good as the top 13 miles because you have some tributaries coming in and some irrigation returns that will kind of, you know, make the water a little unclear and a little, you know, soupy at times down there. Right now, the lower stretches are kind of pea soupy looking. They're still catching fish down there on, you know, hoppers and some dry flies, but it's not clear water like it is on the top 13.
Well, tell us how the river, you know, what kind of river it is for those that have never been there. In other words, you know, is this turned into a freestone? Is it long runs? Does it change its character as it goes down?
Okay. Well, it is a tailwater, meaning that pretty much year-round you have a constant temperature flow. The lake is 600 feet deep, and the main port is down about 400 or 500 feet off the dam. So that introduces cold water into the fishery. Prior to that dam being built, and I believe it was 67, this turned into a prairie warm water stream probably in July and August. I mean, right now we're at August 8th, I think. You know, 80, 90 years ago, this was probably 85 degrees here, and you really didn't have many trout. There were some cutthroats where the springs were, but it was more catfish, squawfish, that type of thing. It was a warm water fishery. The nature of it is a slower gradient. It's not really a mountainous area. We're more in the prairie, Roger. So, you know, there is a horizontal drop, but it's not that much. It's an easy rowing river, unless, like last year, we had 15 or 16,000 cubic feet a second coming through because the whole west was inundated with snowpack and rain. And then it was pretty tough out there. You had to know what you're doing rowing. Right now, it's about 1750 cubic feet a second, very easily waded and rowed. I mean, there's no real danger at this flow.
Mm-hmm.
It's got your typical, you know, riffle, run type thing, flats, you know, long flats. It does get a little weedy because the pH is excellent for growing weeds, insects, and fish. There are limestone walls in the lake, in the reservoir, and that leaches into the water, and it makes it a perfect pH for growing these things. It's essentially an insect factory and a fish factory. And people ask me, well, how do you know where the fish are? They're everywhere. All water is holding water. They can be in, you know, 5 inches of water on a flat, in the deep stuff, on edges, you know, back eddies, etc. It is loaded with fish. Now, the fish count probably is, I haven't had a report in a few years from Fish and Wildlife, but most of the estimates from the guides and outfitters like me are probably 5,000 to 6,000 catchable fish per mile, and that's over 7-inch fish catchable. Years ago, when we had many more consistent flow years in a row, and in the 90s, when we didn't have droughts to deal with, there were upwards of 14,000 catchable fish per mile. And the fishing was a little easier years ago. I have to admit that, because the fish would actually compete with each other to get to your fly. They were a little more aggressive. Now there's plenty of insects, and you have to, it's more of a technical stream right now.
Yeah, there was a question from Joe in Oklahoma. He says, has the fishing on the bighorn returned to what it was 10 years ago? So I don't know what his experience was 10 years ago, but...
Well, 10 years ago, Roger, we were in a drought as well. And it was very good because we didn't have a whole lot of smaller fish. They were there, but you couldn't catch them. I believe it was 10 years ago, and I think it was 03, that year where, I don't know if you were here, but it was very difficult to catch a fish under 18 inches. Very difficult. I mean, we were catching so many fish, and I'm not trying to be a braggart here, but I had a couple of clients that fished New Zealand the previous winter and said we should have saved the 10 grand and come here fishing, because we were catching a lot of 6, 7, 8 pound fish, a lot of them.
Another question from Bill in Big Fork, Montana. Having already been to the Bighorn, he says, I don't see many baby trout in the Bighorn and never have seen many. Like big trout, but are there little ones? Or is that a cause for concern?
That's a good question, because several years ago, during that drought time, the fisheries biologist couldn't find any little ones either. Now, his reasoning was, well, then they're not here. The fish must be eating them all. But every year we get a good year class. Now, what my observations were was that they count fish here by a kind of a primitive method. They come up the river in a jet boat at probably 30 or 40 knots and put electroshocking in the water. I don't like it, because any big fish is going to be gone. You're not going to ever count them. Number two, the little fish, so they won't get eaten, the fry and fish up to 3, 4, 5 inches, tend to stay in the slow, deep, grassy, mossy-filled water, so they can't get eaten. If they're out in the current, they're gone. So they can't really electroshock in those deeper, slow areas with the grass in them. It doesn't get much current. And I told the biologist at the time, I said, follow me. I'm going to show you where the little fish are. I took my wooden boat net, and I stood in about waist-deep water, and I shoved the end of my boat net into the grass, and I come up with 4 or 5 little 3, 4, 5-inch trout. That's where they hang out. You're not going to see them in the main current when it's low like this. Now, last year when we had big water, you could catch a 5 or 6-inch trout on the edges. They were in there because, you know, the current was so extreme, there was really no place for them to hide. And some of them probably got eaten, but not all of them. There's still plenty of little fish around. And historically, this has been a huge growth rate river. By that, I mean the last count I heard, you know, the last study by the fishery biologist was the average yearly growth rate for these trout is 7 to 9 inches per year. That means a 2-year-old trout can be 18 inches.
My gosh.
Phenomenal growth because of the unbelievable insect life in this river. And the other thing about a tailwater river that's good for fishermen is a lot of freestones, they don't have the food quantity that we have. They have bigger bugs, perhaps. I don't know what that is, sorry. They have bigger bugs, but with a lot of small insects. Therefore, these fish have to eat more, which is great for the fishermen. You know, if you get a fish on some, you know, on the Yellowstone or a river like that, it eats a big sculpin, he's probably done for most of the day. These fish are eating a lot of 16s, 18s, 20s, 22, 24, 28, midges and, you know, little sow bugs and things like that. So they have to eat a lot which makes it beneficial for the angler because he's going to have a lot of fish eating most of the day. So that's another characteristic of a tailwater.
One thing that I always enjoyed about the bighorn was the deep runs that you could drift through, and even the places where there were riffles, it's relatively deep riffles. I mean, we're not talking, you know, ankle-deep riffles. We're talking, you know, waist-deep riffles, so to speak,
right.
or runs, rolling runs. And I always enjoyed fishing those areas. And really the whole, you know, other than the little bays that and there's some little side streams and so forth, but it's a big river to fish. And I think that maybe intimidates a lot of people because of its size as well.
Well, it can, especially people that are not from the West here, you know, back where I'm from, you know, New England and the Atlantic coast. The rivers generally are not that big. The easiest way to fish these places is to break them down. You're going to look at a big picture. Well, when you come to this river, you're only going to look at a small picture. You don't look at the whole size of the river. That is overwhelming. You're going to look at the riffle, the tailout, seam edges where the slow water meets the quicker water, inside bends. It's always fabulous fishing on an inside bend on a tailwater because you've got the slow water on the inside bend and the current is on the outside. So when that current goes around the slow water, some of the food in the current gets pushed into the slow water, and these fish can just sit there and eat. One of the things in my presentations that I always say is, big fish are lazy here. Now, they say, well, what do you mean? Aren't the big fish in the big, deep water? No. They're in the shallow water. Why is that? Well, they don't have to fight any current. And remember, these bugs are small. So when they're in the shallow water, the food is concentrated into a shallow water column. The only reason they're going to move if someone walks in on top of them. But I can tell you right now, every fish that I or one of my clients has caught over 24 inches in length has been in under 2 feet of water. I've never caught a big fish in the deep water. Now, part of it is because I don't really fish it anymore. I'm looking for big fish in skinny water, and that's a hoot. When you do that, they're caught with their pants down, and they go psychotic. They take off because they know they shouldn't have been in there. So that's where the big fish are in the bighorn. You can almost step on them. One of my old sayings is, especially in a low water year like this, you could actually fish this river in bedroom slippers if you can cast far enough. You don't have to get your feet wet because fish are in the skinny water, and people don't believe it. I live right on a bluff overlooking the river, and one of the famous holes is right below my house, the hot dog hole. And every morning I see people, probably new to the river, come down with a boat or walk down there or whatever, and they walk out waist deep and they start double hauling and triple hauling. Well, they've walked through all the fish, Roger. The fish are behind them now. They've just walked through, and they think the big fish are out in that heavy water. They're not.
Yeah. I know that's a common mistake we all make, and I shouldn't say we all do, but many, many of us do, and I know I have. For some reason, there's that you're anxious to fish, and you feel like you got to be in the water, you know.
Right.
But many of my guests on the show have said the same thing that you have. Fish that water before you ever put your toe in it, and that's probably where you're going to catch your best fish. Martin Coleman, you just mentioned the hot dog hole, but Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas, he asked a question, what are some of the highlight areas when drifting the bighorn with a guide such as yourself? Are there particular areas you like that are more popular to a lot of fly fishers?
Well, there are so many good, we call them holes here on the bighorn. And a lot of people don't maybe realize that a lot of these flats before islands and things like that where the water slows and it's just a flat piece of water, that will hold a lot of fish. Now, the fish are spooky there, of course, but I like to fish those a lot because big fish will come in there and rest. And a lot of people just row through there because they can't, again, they can't believe that a fish is going to be in 2 feet of slow, flat water. He's in there feeding a little bit and resting, that type of thing. That's my favorite water. The other thing is there's so many famous holes. You got the first island, just below the first island from the After Bay down. It's about, I don't know, maybe 3/8 a mile or so down from the After Bay put in. It's called the meat hole for obvious reasons. It is just a shelf drop-off below an island that is usually loaded with fish. But it gets crowded because people know that. You can walk into it, and you know you're going to catch some fish in there. Some of the other holes, the Hot Dog Island, of course, which is the third island. The second island, which is now called the Split Island a lot because we have a split in it. It's not one whole island. The One Stop, one of my favorite areas is the Snag Hole. It is just below 3 Mile. And if you go left out of 3 Mile, it's a, we call it the Fun Run, the middle of it. It's just usually just loaded with fish. Now, it can be tough to get in there because people know it is loaded with fish. Downstream is a famous spot, the drive-in, which is the old car bodies for people who were fished by here. And that was kind of a historic place because it was an old Sims Gore-Tex ad years ago with three
right.
that posed by it. It's kind of a rusted-out vehicle now, but at one time, there was a lot of paint and chrome on those vehicles, and it's a famous spot still. Crow Beach is another one. Corral Hole, Big Fish Hole. There's actually a corral and a side channel. It's always been famous for big rainbows in that spot. And there's just so many holes.
Yeah.
Now, some of them have changed over the last few years as well, Roger, because of the high water. You know, some of them got filled in, and new holes have been made. And we're still exploring that because it's only been a year since last year, and the fish have moved around to certain places. They're still in the name holes, but a lot of the name holes are reconfigured a little bit. So it'll take time to really, you know, explore all the places because it's, sometimes it's almost like a new river when you have that much water flow through here.
Right,
gravel
right.
has moved, et cetera. So.
Well, Michael, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about fly fishing the Bighorn River. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. To find out more about this premier shop, go to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Michael Mastrangelo about fly fishing the Bighorn River. If you'd like to ask Michael a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Michael, I always ask my guests, what's going on in your fly fishing world? What are you up to there? I know, over many years you were actively involved in conservation efforts on the Bighorn. What you doing today?
Well, I put in 5 years as president, and you know, sometimes those jobs, it was a two-year term, Roger, and you know, not a whole lot of people want to do the grunt work and that kind of stuff. So I gave 5 years. There are other people that are very competent, still protecting the river. I noticed one of your questions was talking about, you know, the ownership of the river. I don't know if you want to get into that a little later, but the Crow Tribe does not own the river. That went to a court case many years ago to the Supreme Court, and it came to the verdict was that the state of Montana owns the river, owns the water, and owns the riverbed up to the high water mark. So that's one advantage of people coming to Montana, is that you can wade fish. Some states like Wyoming and a few others do
Colorado?
Not. Really? Yeah, Colorado. You can't really wade a lot of places. If it's private land, you're out of luck. So Montana is very generous in allowing the general public to do a lot of wade fishing. You've already mentioned the guide school, and it's not only for guides. Most of the people that have come recently just want to take a big leap in their ability and do the week, and it's really helped a lot of people out. We're busy this year. We're having a very, very good year. And I'm a little surprised with the way the economy is because a lot of people are hurting, but people still want to fish, Roger, which is good. I'm glad they have them. So
yeah.
That's basically about what we're doing. I don't want to, you know, take too much of your time talking about myself. I'd rather answer questions and help other people, Roger.
That's great, Michael. If people want to get a hold of you and maybe use your services or find out about the guide school, what's the website they should go to?
The website is www.flyfishingthebighorn.com.
Flyfishingthebighorn.com.
Dot com.
Good. good. Okay, great, great.
The email is on the website or telephone numbers. You can get it off the website.
Okay, great, great. One of the questions we had was going back to talking about the bighorn is, do you have to have a boat? You just mentioned the water access laws there that you can wade. But what's the reality of that? Could a person come up there and do some wade fishing?
Of course, especially in a year like this where we have low water. I mean, there's a lot of wadeable areas right now because it is lower than normal. Normally, we might be in the 3,000 or 3,500 range, which is still plenty of area for people to wade fish. And you gain access through the boat ramps, and then you can walk up or down. Some places this year you can even cross some of these side channels around 3 Mile, which is some of the best wading water on the river. I mean, higher water like last year, you really needed a boat. It was dangerous to wade. And for about 2 or 3 weeks, even the guides, no one waded. It was all boat fishing because it was so fast. I mean, the fishing was excellent, but it was just dangerous. You know, 15, 16,000 is a lot of water. But normally, you can wade all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really, it's not tough wading. It's a gravel bottom river. Some of the rocks can be a little slippery, but there's no real, you know, tremendous rapids where you're going to get sucked into. It's a pretty gentle prairie stream. And
right.
I'm glad it, because I'm no young kid anymore myself. I've got a, you know, I like to wade, so I do a lot of wading, and I'm not a young guy anymore. But I'm still pretty agile for an old timer. You know? But
one thing I remember about fishing the bighorn is that, you know, you use the boat for transportation, of course, to get to a lot of these places, like you were talking about, to fish for the big fish and, the side channels and banks that you can't really fish from a boat. But I remember getting caught up in wade fishing so much that at the end of the day we were going to take out at the 13-mile point down there at the bighorn, and we really had to kind of hoof it down the river to get out of there before dark because we got so caught up in doing wade fishing on the river.
Exactly. And like I said earlier, all water is holding water. You can catch fish in some water that you look at and say, most people would say, there can't be any fish in there. Well, they're in there because there's so many fish per mile. So it's a great river. And I don't mean to toot my own horn on the bighorn, but no pun intended.
Yeah.
But I'm not here for the nightlife, Roger. I'm here.
No, that's for sure.
Yeah,
Martin,
going on here after dark.
Yeah, Martin Coleman, Lawrence, Kansas, asked you that. What makes the bighorn such a great river for fly fishing compared to other rivers?
Okay. Well, we touched on it earlier. The tailwater system, the double dam, the re-regulation in the major dam, the pH of the water, the limestone in it, and the other factor is, I believe it's since 1981, Montana does not stock any rivers in the state. They manage all the rivers for wild trout. So these are wild fish you're going to catch. Now, like we said earlier, I grew up catching a lot of saltwater fish. They could really give you a tug and, you know, escape and, you know, basically punish you. These fish are similar. And, you know, here we go again. I'm biased, but these fish can act like steelhead. I've had so many fish with clients go into their backing, just take off. And I've had my butt kicked by 14, 15-inch browns on this river. You get them in, you say, that couldn't have been that fish. It must have been a 23-inch rainbow. No, it's a small brown that are very, very tough. So the fish are wild, and they're tough. And they really, you know, they fight to the death. I get some clients that say, oh, he's not ready yet. You know what? They're never ready. And you have fished this river, so you know these trout don't quit. So that's what I love about the place. And that is what
that
makes it different in a lot of places.
The first time I went fishing there, and we were with a guide, and the first fish I caught was about a probably 19, 20-inch brown. And when I hooked up with that fish, I thought it was hung up. And I'm telling the guide, I'm hung up, you know. I'm hung up. I got to get, you know. He says, you're not hung up. That's a fish. The fish was so strong, though, I thought it was hung up on a rock or a log or something. And it was amazing, the strength of that fish. And from that point on, I had a new respect for that river, I'll tell you.
Well,
so what kind of fish are we talking about in the bighorn? Browns and rainbows? Is that
Browns and rainbows. There are some other fish. You know, we have a small amount of Rocky Mountain whitefish, not like some other rivers. they do tend to come up from the Yellowstone, which, you know, this river doesn't have a dam at the bottom of it. It flows into the Yellowstone, but generally it's browns and rainbows. You get a few cut bows occasionally because there was a little remnant of cutthroats here years ago, and now it's almost gone. I think I caught one fish that had a little bit of a slash, and I'll tell you, they fight hard. They're tough fish, some of those cut bow remnants. And that's basically it. I mean, there's some carp in some of the slow waters around here, but they don't get in your way.
Yeah.
You know, I've even seen a few northern pike on the river occasionally. But
what are the current regulations? Is it catch and release? Is there a take or limit or flies lures? What are the regulations?
Right now, there is no catch and release on the river. I would like to see that eventually, and we've been trying to work for that for years. But this part of Montana, there's a lot of people that, you know, want to keep their fish, and, you know, it's legal, so I don't get involved in it. You can take five fish per day, only one over 18 inches, and that's a mixture of rainbows and browns. For a while, they were protecting the rainbows a little more. You could only take one, but now it's mixture, rainbows, browns, one over 18. So there is a slot limit, and most people that come out here, Roger, they're not keeping fish. I mean, I see a lot of people, the natives keep some fish, but that's more for, you know, subsistence living for them. But most people don't keep them, which is good. I have grandchildren now. I have four young ones, and I want to see them come out here in a few years and catch some fish. So we try to conserve the fishery.
I did get some questions here, kind of follow-up questions on pH. Peter Hingle in Lewistown asked, how do you do pH tests, and what is the ideal pH in the river?
I believe, I haven't taken it this year, but the pH historically has been 7, which is kind of a neutral. Now, sometimes it wavers a little bit. It might go a little more alkaline, and it probably could be a little more acidic, but it's roughly around 7. Any little pH testing kit that you can get through mail order, you can go into your own stream or river. And I test the water sometimes. I drink, you know, just see what it is. I like a little more alkaline drinking water. But it's generally around 7, Roger,
okay,
which is good for neutral. It's good for growing things in the river, especially, you know, some of the vegetation, which grows the insects, which grows the trout.
Another question came in on the Internet. Dan Trela, he says, I fished the bighorn last week, and he heard about fish kill and excess nitrogen in the water. Do you know where and how the nitrogen gets in the water?
Yeah.
So he said he saw some dead fish, et cetera.
Yeah, well, anytime, and part of it is the low water. Now, these fish, generally fish that grow this quickly, do not live long, long lives. The big ones do. But the average lifespan, according to the biologist here, is 3, 4, 5 years, generally 3 to 4, probably. And when they die in faster water, because they will die, in fast water they get washed downstream. Because the water has been lower, they sink to the bottom and stay there. So if you're going by in a boat, you say, oh, there's a dead fish. Then 100 yards down, there's another dead fish. So historically, when we have faster water, you don't really see them. The other thing about the nitrogen, yes, they've been working on the Afterbay Dam since last October, much to my chagrin. And they were working on the radial gates and the side slough gate. And they had the radial gates, which go up and down to let water in from the after bay into the river. The slough gate just comes in quick, and there's a drop. There's a, you know, the vertical drop when it comes through that gate. And when you have water dropping quite a distance into another body of water, the river, you get dissolved gases in it and dissolved nitrogen. And this, usually near the top mile or so, you will catch fish. I haven't caught any in a couple of weeks, but prior to that this year, we were catching some fish that had bubbles under their skin. And that's the nitrogen that gets into their system and it gets under their skin. And what happens is some will die. Some, the strong ones with a good immune system, don't die. They get better. But some that might be older or, you know, maybe some browns that didn't survive the spawn well, because the browns are spawning later and later because we've had warmer water into, like, December. So they're spawning December and January now instead of October, November. So these bubbles get under some of their skin, especially near their gill plates. And eventually it wears away the mucus protection in their skin, and they get like a fungus under it. They will turn black, the fish. And you'll see some fish, I haven't seen any in probably 2 or 3 weeks, but they can get all black, and that fish can't really swim much, can't feed, and it will die. It really, you know, our rumors spread that, oh, there's a huge fish kill. Not, I didn't see anything, because I would have been up in arms. There were some fish that do die because of this, and I don't really like it, but they had to work on this dam, and the problem was they've been working on it since last October, and they're still, most of it, is, the work is done, but you're talking 8-9 months of work, and that gases, those gases did get into the river, and it didn't help the fishery, I'll be honest with you. But there's still plenty of fish to be caught.
There's a couple of questions here about, because, you know, the bighorn is so popular, like Bob in Rhode Island asks, do you think that the river is overfished and too crowded nowadays? What's your feeling on that?
Well, my feeling is I don't like regulation. They've done some regulation on the Beaverhead and Big Hole because they thought the guides, a lot of it was local Montana residents, which they've got a right to fish. But they thought there were too many guides on the weekend, so they couldn't get access to the river. Now, that's not totally true. So what they did, Fish, Wildlife, and Game, and the Parks Department, came down with some restrictions. And they restricted guides on certain parts of those rivers on the weekend, so they couldn't fish them with clients. And what happened is, it sometimes happens when you start regulating, the rivers became more crowded on the weekend because everyone said, oh, there's no more guides here. Let's go fishing. And they actually defeated the purposes why they wanted these regulations here. I believe let's not have the restrictions. If people come here and they say, you know, it's too crowded for me, fine. Wherever you have great fishing, and I mean great fishing, you're going to have crowds. If you find a bonefish island in the middle of the Pacific and you're catching 20-pound bonefish, believe me, in 2 years, there's going to be 27 lodges there, and you're going to be crowded on those flats. The fishing public has become so broad and so extensive that wherever you have great fishing, you're going to see people. Now, the other side of the coin is, you know, I tell some people, well, if you really want isolation, you can hike up the Bear Toots at 11,000 feet, and you won't see another person. You'll probably see grizzly bears, but you'll be catching, you know, maybe a 7-inch golden trout.
Right.
If you want
different kind of
fish, you know, you're just going to have to go with the crowds. And it will regulate itself, I believe, because some people, they want more solitude, you know, when it's not as crowded.
Yeah. Frank in Ashland, Pennsylvania, kind of extended that question. And he said, would you favor restrictions on rental craft in order to decrease pressure on the river, or would you favor special permitting for guides in order to restrict access to guides that are outside the area? It sounds like you're not for that kind of restrictions, right?
Well, once you start getting into restrictions, Roger, it never ends. It's like there's a little tax on your telephone bill that started in 1914, I think, for World War I to help pay for the war. It's still on it. This is 2012, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Leave it alone. If people don't like it, they don't have to come. They can go somewhere else. There's many rivers in Montana where you're going to be the only person around for a mile or two.
Yeah.
Once you start regulating it, I think it hurts the fishery.
Yeah, the reality of that, though, I think in the long run it probably will get regulated. I know I do a lot of whitewater rafting, you know, and most of the places that are the premium places to whitewater raft in Colorado, Utah, Arizona, including the Grand Canyon, you know, you got to get a permit to get on the river, and you got to go into lotteries. And the reason is that there'd just be too many boats on the river. You'd be bumper to bumper. Rafting's a little bit different than fishing, but it may get to that point because we've all seen so many change in my lifetime to where, you know, places I used to backpack in and see no one, well, now there's 50 people back there, you know, so it's changing everywhere.
It's a natural progression of government to get bigger. It never seems to get smaller. So that will happen eventually, and it'll be a sad to me.
Well, let's take a quick break, Michael, and when we come back, we'll get into some more things about fly fishing the bighorn.
Mm-hmm.
Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon. Indian River, and no motor zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com, flatstime.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Michael Mastrangelo about fly fishing the Bighorn River. If you'd like to ask Michael a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Mike, let's talk a little bit about the Fort Smith area there for people coming up there. I know you have cabins at your place. What are the other accommodations that can be found up there? It's been a while since I've been up there, so.
Okay. There are motels. There are lodges. You have a bed and breakfast in town now. You have some cabins that will, you know, provide cooking facilities. There is a part-time restaurant. I don't know if it's open anymore. It seems to be open at times, but we used to have a Paulie's Place. Now it's kind of part-time. I'm not sure what the hours are, but it's really, you almost have to either bring your food yourself or stay at a place that will provide meals. There is also camping. There's public camping at the After Bay Lake on both sides of it and at 13-mile access. It's the state and the government. I'm not sure what the fees are, but it's not really primitive, but you don't really have hookups at those places. There are two private campgrounds where you can get hookups and showers and electricity and that kind of stuff. So it kind of works for everyone's budget. There are high-end places and, you know, bare minimum places.
Right. And it's still a bring-your-own-liquor destination, right?
It is. We are in the Crow Indian Reservation, and no alcohol is sold here. Generally, we tell our clients that, you know, if you fly into Billings or drive through Hardin or Billings or Sheridan, you know, if you want beer, wine, et cetera, buy it there and bring it here. You can drink here, but you can't purchase it here.
And what about the lodges and so forth? Are they allowed to provide liquor? I suppose not, right?
They're really not. I mean, unless maybe some of them have, you know, maybe like in Salt Lake City, you become a club member for a dollar or something, and they could provide you with alcohol. We don't. We just ask people to bring their own, whatever
they
want.
So even if you're in a lodge or resort or something, you have to bring your own. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about seasons on the Bighorn. Got a question here. Joe from Oklahoma says he can't tolerate the cold weather because of his circulatory condition. What would be the best time for him to come and fish the Bighorn?
Well, it would probably be now.
When it's 105.
That's what I mean. He's not going to have any circulatory issues. But generally, you know, when you're talking about weather, you can only say historically. I mean, you know, you can get crazy weather anytime. But if I was him, I would try to come July, August, you know, somewhere in there where you're guaranteed almost that you're going to get some hot weather and it's going to be good fishing, you're going to get more dry flies. And you're not going to freeze out there. I mean, I understand people have illnesses and maybe poor circulation. You don't want to come out here in the winter because the water is cold and the weather can be cold. However, we are kind of in a little banana belt here, and we get a lot of great days. Not as good as Denver area, but a lot of great winter days where, I mean, the month of March this year, the average daily temperature here was 63 degrees. I fished almost every day. There was not many people around. I had some guide trips, but we had midges and betas all day long, dry fly all day long. It was hot out, beautiful. So tell that person, stick with the summer months if you have that type of an issue with your circulation. But winter can be great, and we get a lot of people from Colorado come up because, you know, on a Thursday they can look at the weather and say, hey, you know, it's going to be pretty good in Montana on the weekend. Let's drive up, fish Friday, Saturday, come home Sunday. So you might have done that yourself before, but we have a lot of people that, you know, within 400, 500, 600 miles, you can get here within a day.
Are you guys open all year?
We will provide guide service, but the cabins close because it's so iffy. You know, there are other cabins around. We can put people in different places, but we still guide people. We have guides available, but we don't, you know, we don't run the cabins because it's, you never know. You're going to have to trickle water, keep the heat on. If you get no one for 2 weeks, it's not a cost-effective way to operate.
Right. Dan, from, I'm assuming he's from Bismarck, this interesting question about snow and cold, him being in Bismarck. But he said, how's the fishing late September to early October? Is this area susceptible to snow and cold at that time of the year, like the western Montana rivers?
Well, we don't have the elevation. We're in a valley. So we're at about 3,400 feet in this valley. And like I said, we get a lot of nice weather. We get many, many days of sun. It used to be almost 300 days of sun here. Last several years, it's not as much. We get more clouds than we used to. However, you know, any time that time of year, September, October, it's a transitional month. Anything is possible. And I remember a few storms where we got a foot of snow, like September 28th. September 29th, it was 80 degrees. So it generally, you can only, you know, I wish I was a weatherman because that's my next career. You can be wrong every day and still get a paycheck every two weeks.
Yeah.
So it's tough to predict, but generally those are good months. It's a little less crowded. We still get some dry flies that time of year. You know, you can fish, you know, a long day. The days are still pretty long here. It's not, you know, dark at 5:30 that time of year.
Right.
And it's still pretty good. You get some cooler nights, warmer days, typical fall weather generally.
Mm-hmm. Andy from Los Angeles wrote in, and he wants to know, he's got a trip to the Bighorn at the end of August. He wants to spend most of his time dry fly fishing. Is that a good time of year for dries, or will he have to throw nymphs and streamers to be productive?
Again, historically, very good.
Okay.
But we're starting to get some black caddis coming on pretty strong. I even saw some tan caddis coming up today. We have pale morning duns hatching probably from about 10:30 in the morning till 4:30 or 5 right now. And by then, he should have some trichos. They're coming. So that's another couple of weeks. We should have some trichos by then. So he's going to spend most of his time dry fly fishing. Now, hoppers have been kind of not what they have been the last 4 years. The reason number one is lower water. The water is not getting up into the brush or the banks like it did before. So when you have a wind, the hoppers are not getting blown in as much. Number two, we haven't had that much wind. People have fished the Bighorn and probably saying, what? You know, this is known as a windy place. Not as windy as the North Platte, but it's still windy. We haven't had those big northwest winds that blow hoppers off the wheat fields into the river. But we caught three or four today. You know, we didn't fish them that long, but we had three or four fish eat a hopper. So he should have that also. So that time of year is great for dry fly fishing.
Okay, and George from Alabama asked about, is there a time for big streamers on the Bighorn? Is that an effective method?
Yes. Generally, it's fall, winter, spring. However, this year, these fish wanted streamers. And every day that's a little cloudy, I've been putting streamers on. And you can get 40, 50 fish days on streamers. I've had a couple within the last couple of weeks. But lately, it's been pretty sunny. When it gets that sunny, they don't seem to want to chase them as much. When you have a little overcast, that lower light, they will chase them because the fish are hungry. In the fall, certainly before the brown trout spawn, they get more aggressive for a while, and they will chase them. Rainbows will chase them. All winter, most of what I throw is going to be that. We do get some midges in the winter, but it's only an hour or two a day. And in the spring, early spring, you know, cold, nasty weather, it's like steelhead weather. You can get a lot of fish on that streamer. Streamer's a preferred method here. And even big ones.
You want to name drop any particular patterns that work well?
Well, any woolly bugger is going to work. Mm-hmm. This summer, black has worked great. I mix a little blue in it. Blue is an interesting color. Most people don't think blue. But I use a lot of blue in my nymphs, dry flies, etc., spinners. Blue is, it's an interesting color. Fish are attracted to it. But a black and blue streamer, white, any type of, you know, that some of these, you know, new exotic type streamers with the crazy names, you know, I don't, Kelly Gallops type streamers, they will work. Meat whistle, you know, Don Barr's meat whistle, that works. But any woolly bugger, now sometimes you don't want to make the tail too long, Roger, because you'll get some short strikes occasionally. I use a short tail, so if they do hit it there, they'll probably get hooked. Those long, long tails, sometimes they just nip at them and they won't catch them. But you got to get down on the bottom with the fish, down to them. If you're not on the bottom, they're not going to eat them. You're going over their head.
A question came in on the Internet. John from Maine says, I guess he's coming out next week, wants to know about terrestrials. I think you pretty well covered that. They're kind of on and off right now, right?
On and off. There have been some beetles and ants around. I would not come here this time of year without beetles and ants. Because a lot of times you don't see them, and you're saying, what the heck is that fish eating? You put a beetle on, and you're going to know what he's eating. They must taste fabulous to the trout, because especially beetles, they love them. Any kind of ant, get an amber ant here, too.
We got Bruno in Pittsburgh also wants to know about upcoming black caddis hatch and what the most effective patterns are for that hatch.
Well, they're happening now, and even on the top 3 miles, which I fished today, down below they're happening as well. And they're coming in the daytime. I saw them about 11 o'clock this morning, and they were intermittent through the day. Now, they probably will be coming late at night, too, just at dark. Patterns, you know, you can go with the old elk hair caddis pattern. I tend to use a CDC pattern. It just, they eat it better. Now, if you can keep it afloat, a lot of people drag it under and it makes it tough to clean it. I use synthetic hair. Caddis pupa, they eat a lot of those. A lot of times you'll see these fish slash. When you're seeing slashes a lot, they're probably eating the pupa, which is emerging. They come up and they're in the air. They don't hang on the water like a mayfly would. They come right up through the surface and they're in the air. So a lot of times you won't see the actual insect, and you'll say, what the heck are they eating? Well, a lot of times now they're eating a caddis pupa just under the surface film. And I would usually drop that off a black caddis adult.
There you go.
You can swing it too. They'll eat motion with that, and they'll attack it.
I remember ending a day at Bighorn Access. I think right there by the parking lot, like on the other side, there's like a slow area on the other side of the river. And we just drifted in there, just ready to pull out. And the black caddis were so thick in there, they were just coating our arms. Our arms were black. I couldn't believe how many caddis were coming out of that river. And the fish were just going nuts.
I've had so many nights where I come in, and you know the new fishing shirts, they're vented.
Yeah.
And you take the shirt off when you come in the house, and a hatch goes on in your living room. All up in your shirt. I'm not kidding. That's my wife.
Yeah, they get everywhere, huh?
Complaining about
it. Yeah. David from Johnson City, New York, wanted to know, he's going to be in Montana in 10 days and would like to know, if you only had 3 nymphs and 3 dry flies, what would you tie for the trip?
Well, it depends on where he's fishing, of course. I know what I would do for here. General attractor patterns, depending on where he's going, I would probably do like an elk hair caddis tan, a stimulator, probably some form of terrestrial, a hopper or a beetle, nymphs. You know, a lot of people like these beadhead nymphs, the copper johns, and I still like a pheasant tail and a hare's ear. They work every place, so I would go with something like that. And depending on where you're fishing, you just adjust the size, etc., to what the bugs are. You know, some places you're going to get 12, 14 size nymphs. Here you're going to get smaller ones. So with those flies, I don't think you can go wrong. You can probably catch fish and throw in a woolly bugger somehow, and you can always catch fish on that.
Question in on the Internet, Eric in Billings says, it seems to me that the San Juan worm was more effective a few years ago than it is now. Have you noticed that same thing, Mike?
Yeah, I have. Last year it worked pretty good. We had a lot of water, as I've previously spoken about. We had 15, 16,000 CFS. That pushes these aquatic worms out of the silt. Now, last year, because of the high flow, we don't have as much silt in the water, and that's generally where these worms live. We don't have the scuds we normally have either. There's some scuds around. I know that was a question. We have sow bugs, but the scuds are not really here much. There's a few of them, but not like it usually is, because I think we lost a lot of the silt from those drought years. It got washed away. They'll come back, because wherever you have crustaceans, specifically scuds, you have big fish. And they'll come back. They're cyclical, the scuds.
But still quite a few sow bugs. I know that was a pretty hot pattern last time I was up there.
Yeah, we tend to use the Ray Charles pattern, which is a sow bug. It's made with ostrich hurl, and it's got mylar over the back, and it's a fabulous pattern. It's been here for 25 or 30 years. And they're still they ate it today. I mean, we fished a few nymphs early in the morning. They did eat it. So it's a great pattern. And there's still some sow bugs, but the scuds, not many around this year. They will make a comeback, though. Like I said, they're cyclical.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned quite a few hatches. Well, I think, I'm looking at a hatch chart for the bighorn here that I happen to have. But what do you consider the major hatches up there on the river that one should be prepared for and, you know, type, you know, as far as
hatches generally start? Like this year, we had some betas and midges starting in February, and they continue. Mostly it's March, April, May, the betas and midges strong. Where the midges cluster, the betas are profuse. We still have betas going on right now in the sun. It was hot, 103, bright sun, not a cloud in the sky, and the fish were eating betas today. It was the greatest betas hatch I've ever seen here. They usually stop at about the middle of May, but they've continued through the summer. Normally, the end of May, June, not many hatches. You're nymphing a little bit more. Once July comes in, you can have yellow sallies, which we had great last year. There were some this year, but we didn't have as much fast water. There were stonefly, a little one, a little yellow stone. Last year, they were phenomenal. This year, they're still catching a few fish. We're seeing a few of them. Pale morning duns start in July, about middle July. Usually the hoppers get going, the terrestrials, black caddis, and then sometimes tan caddis. I'm hoping they come because the fish really key on them. And you can skate them. You can skitter them, which makes it easy even for a beginner. You don't have to have that dead drift. When you can skitter a caddis and they eat it, that's nothing like that. It's great fun. Also, trichos. They're starting down the lower river right now, so they should be up on the top 13 miles within a week or two. And that was great last year. I mean, every morning we're out there fishing for 3-4 hours, trichos. You know, the females hatch first in the morning, the males the night before, and then you get a spinner fall after the females are done. And that's been great. So that should be happening soon. So we've got quite a few hatches, and we've also got some pseudo-clones, which are hatching right now. They're a small mayfly like a betis. They're a little more yellowish-golden. And they're usually 20, 22, 24, and they will hatch into October at least. The fish eat them, but they're smaller flies, so you have to be a little more on the fish. I mean, you have to be very accurate with them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's a pretty good array of hatches we have here.
Yeah, I'd say. So the best thing to do is to call someone like you in advance of your trip and find out, you know, what's happening. Because like you say, in different years, it may shift a month or either way
right.
As far as what's coming off, right?
Yes, I generally send out river reports, and I'm fairly good at that. Sometimes I get so busy it may be a few weeks before I send one. But anyone that went to my website can sign up for the river report via email. We don't really send out hard copies because it'd be
right.
Too much too involved. So you can sign up for that. There should be another one coming out probably next week on what's been happening. So we try to help people that way.
Okay.
Or just call any shop in town or email or, you know, go on their website. Most places give a river report, and they'll be happy to help you with what's going on.
Right. Need to take another quick break, Michael. When we come back, we'll talk with Michael Mastrangelo more about fly fishing the Bighorn River. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? The help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic papers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Michael Mastrangelo about fly fishing the Bighorn River. If you'd like to ask Michael a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Michael, a question came in from Eric in Apple Valley, Minnesota. He wanted to know about deer and fly list, and what do you recommend someone bring as far as weight, rod, length, and so forth?
Okay, well, this, as we spoke earlier, this is kind of a big river. We do get some wind. I would not really bring 3-4 weights, especially not 3 weights. If you're dealing with wind, it's tough casting. I would go with a more 5-6 weight rod. A little more backbone to get those flies out there and to fight the fish. You know, a 3 weight, you get a big fish on a 3 weight, it's going to be a tussle because these fish, they fight well, as you know.
Right.
If you're throwing streamers, I tend to go with 6-7 weights because it makes life easier. I mean, you can throw them with 5 weights, but I like to throw tandem streamers. I throw 2 just because that's my style. I like 2 of everything. So if you're throwing a couple coneheads, you want a little backbone to cast that thing. So I would think a little heavier than you might in Minnesota if you're trout fishing there, or maybe, you know, the northeast or the east coast. Heavier stuff because you're fighting wind, you're fighting some bigger fish, and it's going to make your life easier, especially if it blows. You want other gear recommendations or reels, et cetera? I mean, reels, I like something with a decent drag. You got to have a little drag on the reel. Some people want to, you know, they come out with reels with no drag, and it's going to get overruns, and you want a little pressure on that fish. Not too much, but enough that it's a quick starting drag. It's not going to get, you know, hesitate and break off a fish. Something, you know, that you can spend at least 70, 80, 90 bucks on, you can get a great reel for that kind of money.
Plus some backing on that reel, right?
Backing. I mean, you know, you got to fill it up. I'd like to put at least 100 yards on it. People say, what? This is trout fishing. The biggest fish I ever had a client catch took us in and out of the backing 4 times, and it took us 300 yards downstream. Now, people think I'm talking about a steelhead. This fish behaved like it. It was a rainbow, 28 inches, at least 10 pounds. I couldn't really weigh it. My guess was it felt like a 10-pound sack of potatoes, and it just took off, and we had to run downstream to catch it. And, you know, we needed all that backing. So it doesn't hurt to have it. You never know. If you catch a big fish, a fish of a lifetime, and you got 20 yards of backing on, and he spools you and it breaks off, you're going to kick yourself for not having that backing.
Right, right. What about tippets for nymphing and dry fly fishing both? What size tippets do you recommend?
Okay. I generally like, for nymphing, most of my guides and myself, we start with a 9 foot 3X, which is 7-8 pound tippet. And we build off of that. Most guides out here fish 2 flies to give them a choice. So we'll put a piece of 4X on that 3X, and that connection 3 to 4X is a piece of weight. And then we'll put the fly. Generally, we start about 16, 18 inches between flies. Then another piece of 4X. I go heavy at first. I want to catch these fish on the heaviest line I can. Reason being, I don't want to fight them a long time and stress the fish out. I want to get them in. And if they eat 3X, 4X, whatever they're going to eat, that's what I feed them. I don't use a whole lot of light stuff. I mean, I've had people come here with 8, 9X tippets for dry flies. You're not going to land these fish on 8X. 7X, I think it's too light. I may be biased or prejudiced, but I try to feed them 5X on a dry fly. And 5X usually fits through about a 22 hook. Sometimes I use Orvis Big Eye hooks or Daiichi or something. I want to feed them 5X. It's important to have slack in your leader, especially dry fly fishing. If you don't have slack, you got a straight leader, it's very tough to catch these fish because the fish are smart. This was one of your other questions. These fish will get educated here because they're fished over by a lot of people. My old buddy that used to be my number one guide passed away years ago. His favorite saying was, there are fish here that can do your taxes, and I don't doubt that. They get educated quickly. So you need slack. Slack is your friend, all right? Even aerial men's mending. My license plate, since I've moved here, says mend, and it's the most important thing in fly fishing. You can have an $800 rod, $500 reel, $100 line, the best flies in the world. If you don't mend it right, you don't get any fish here.
So, right.
But heavier leaders than you think, you can always go lighter. But if you get break-offs at 5, 6, 7X, you know, if you like to tie flies, bring that stuff. If you don't, bring the heavier stuff. And I, like I said, I don't want to stress fish out. Get them in quick. If you use the right angles and techniques, you can land these fish very fast, even if they're tough. You can still get them in. That's a whole other show, to be honest with you.
Yeah, just editing one of the transcriptions for one of the shows I did with Jason Borger, and he was talking about how to do your aerial mends, you know, all different directions, left, right, forward, and back. And I think that's where a lot of people could spend a lot more time practicing their aerial mends, not the on-river mends, because those are...
100% right. One other addition here. Try to practice your casting before you come out west, because casting is so important. You may be fighting a breeze, and even a 5-mile-an-hour breeze. When you're on your lawn, you know, you're in Pennsylvania or something, and there's no wind, yeah, you can throw 70 feet of line. When you get a 5 or 10 mile wind in your face with a longish leader for dries, it's a different story. So practice loading and unloading that rod, because out here, big river, big wind, you need line speed to get those flies out. Very important. And not enough people do that, I'm sad to say, but I think people are starting to do that more and more, because they come out to the west and they don't get the fish they should because they can't make that cast. It's very important. Invest in a casting school or buy some casting videos and just practice. I've been fishing a long time. I practice at least 3 times a week on my front lawn. And I still
I'm still
looking to improve.
You know, and wind, it's not only in the west, but if you go saltwater fishing, you almost always got a wind.
Yeah. You better believe it.
Yeah. Is there any need for sink tip line on the bighorn, or floating line good for everything?
At times, sink tip, right now with the water's lower, so if you do fish streamers, generally you can get away with a floating line. But in the fall, winter, spring, I use T200 or T250 24-foot sink tip. You have to get these flies down. And a lot of fish in the winter, when it's colder, get into these deep holes because the water's warmer at the bottom down there, and they don't move much. And if you don't get down to them, you're just pulling that streamer way over the head, and you're not going to really attack it. You're going to get right in the face when it's cold out here. So I always carry a sink tip if I'm streaming.
Greg from Rapid City wrote in, and he wanted to know, for beginners on the bighorn, do you think it's easier for them to fish with wet or dry flies? Like it's nymphing versus dry flies.
Personally, I think it's easier for nymphing or wet flies, you know, fishing in wet. Number one, I recommend indicators, especially to beginners, because it not only is it a strike indicator, Roger, it also acts as a float. It helps you get the drift, because if you mend it correctly, that indicator is like a dry fly. It's going to tell if that's drifting dead, like I think Al Troth once said years ago, you make the indicator look as if it's attached to nothing. If you do that and you get a dead drift with that indicator, and you get the right flies and weight on, you're going to catch a lot of fish. So that's very important, that indicator. And I, all beginners that I take out, I recommend the indicator. If they don't want to do it, fine. We'll work without it, or we'll high stick, or we'll just roll the bottom, as some people call it, whatever they want. But an indicator does help people get onto fish faster. And once they get it, the hang of it, they can switch. Personally, I don't use one. I try to feel for the fish.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, you know, I'm not only Czech, Polish, nymphing, that stuff, but, I mean, that stuff's been going on 50, 60 years. I got a friend here that grew up in New Jersey. In 1959, he was basically Czech nymphing for a flounder in the bays of New Jersey. So it's not, there's nothing new under the sun, as they say.
Mm-hmm. We had a question on the Internet about Czech nymphing. Eric in Billings wrote in, and he says, have you tried any Czech nymphing techniques on the bighorn?
I kind of do it. I do something a little differently. I use a little longer leader than the Czech nymphing does, and I do lead it through the hole. And I, what I do is I kind of watch where my fly line and leader meet, and there's a little bit of sag right there. And I watch it. If those nymphs or the lead do anything, it kind of jumps. I mean, it's kind of close to Czech nymphing. One of my guides, Chad, that helps me run the fly fishing school here, he does a lot of it with, you know, the 10-foot four weights and that kind of stuff. He's mm-hmm. into a lot of that stuff. But, mm-hmm. I mean, it's not really that new. It's a rage right now, a lot of people getting into it, but there are people who've been doing it for a long time without the indicator and kind of leading the flies through the hole.
Bruno in Pittsburgh wrote in, and he wanted to know, what is the one thing you would suggest fly fishermen coming to the bighorn for the first time from the east? What would you suggest for them? He says retain boats and guides, but your advice is very much appreciated. So east coast fishermen coming west coast, their western Rockies, what would be the one thing you'd suggest they do or bring?
Right, well, other than a guide to help the person, number one thing that I see, and I'm an east coast guy originally, is when you hook the fish, you have to move with these fish. If you stay static, the fish will get downstream into your backing, and then you're fighting the fish and the current. When you move with the fish downstream and you get across from him or below stream of him, below where he's in the current is now helping you. And you're not going to fight the fish for 15 minutes and jeopardize his life. You have to move with the fish. That's the number one thing to see from people that fish, you know, northeast, other places like that. They do not move with the fish. You have to get downstream with the fish.
One of the things that, and I don't know if you agree with this or not, but, you know, you see the standard, I think Jason Borger talked about as the praying position, hooking up with the fish, the rod goes straight up in the air, and then they're static, I think, like you were just talking about, rather than, you know, leading the fish to, you know, if the fish goes right, put your rod down low, go to the left. The fish goes left, put your rod down low. But always trying to move their head rather than stay in a static position. Would you agree for the bighorn fish?
Generally, I agree. There's a quote on my website by Ted Williams, the famous Boston Red Sox hitter. And he says, the angle of pressure is more important than the amount of pressure. You fight their lateral line or their head. So think about that, and I give a lot of presentations just on this specific fish fighting. I don't even call it fighting, Roger. We're going to steer the fish. We're not going to fight him. Fight him is violence. We're going to steer him. We're going to use his energy against himself like jujitsu, okay? And I can't, it's tough to explain on the telephone, but you're going to move the fish. You're going to use the current. You're going to move with the fish. It's the thinking man's game. Anybody can hook a fish, can basically get adrift and hook a fish. Basically, the hook set itself here and the fight is when the cerebellum comes into place, the brain. This is when you think, because you're going to react to what the fish is doing. Watch the fish. Even if you can't see him underwater, you know where is his head, etc., and you're going to react to that. So Jason knows his stuff, and you
have
to hook the fish to get him in.
Another tip was that, you know, if you're fishing whatever the circumstance, a seam, a riffle, a pool, you should in advance know where you want to bring that fish if you hook up and kind of plan ahead on, you know, where can you move to? Like you said, can you move downriver? You know, how are you going to steer it? And you'll end up landing a lot more fish if you pre-plan your fight. So anyway, that was another interesting tip I came across.
That's a good point. And,
yeah.
You know, especially steelheading. I mean, I used to fish the Pere Marquette, Michigan, a small intimate stream. And you better think about, if you hook that fish, you see, where's he going to go and what are you going to do with him?
Yeah.
The other thing is, I wanted to preface the whole conversation with this. There's no experts in fly fishing. No one could live long enough to know it all. That's the beauty of it. You're always learning. I'm learning. Maybe I sound like I know it all, but I love learning. Every day, almost, I go out with a beginner, maybe, and they do some cast and mend, and they catch a fish. And I adopt that into my repertoire. It may not look pretty. This doesn't have to look pretty. It's got to work. And the goal of fly fishing to me is to get the fish in safe, take a photo, look at it. And I hate losing fish. So I figured out ways to get these guys in. I don't personally, I'm a competitive guy, and I want to get them in. When I lose a fish, I go ballistic. I do. I'm sorry, but I do.
We're running out of time here, but there is one question at the end that I think was kind of interesting that I'd like to fit in here before we tie things up here. Frank Garcia in Santa Fe, New Mexico wrote in. He says, Michael, why is setting the hook for a feisty bighorn brown or a strong bighorn rainbow such a challenge. You almost have to have nanosecond instinct that the trout is going to take your fly. Many a time I would hear you say rather forcefully, "Set it, set it." What is the secret to setting and hooking a fish on the Great Bighorn River?
Okay. Most people, when they nymph, let's say, with an indicator, they wait for the big bang. By that I mean that indicator takes off. If you watch films of fish, and I've watched these fish eat, they don't bite the fly. They might bite a bait fish or a small trout. They don't bite the fly. They basically inhale it, almost like a bass, and eject it fast. So in a millisecond, they've got that fly in their mouth and out. And that they don't have hands where they can pick it up and look at it or touch it. They have to do everything with their mouth. So it's in and out of their mouth so quick. And you'll watch an indicator do something. I look for speed. I watch the indicator speed because sometimes it slows almost imperceptibly. And I've been watching these things for 25 years. That's when you set the hook. And it doesn't hurt to ever set the hook. Years ago, I had a client out here that didn't want a dry fly. It was in July. We had great dry fly. He wanted a nymph. And I was watching him, and he hooked so many fish. I can't tell you the number. You wouldn't believe it. But what he was doing was setting the hook on a drift every 4 or 5 feet. And he was hooking up fish left and right. And it taught me a lesson. I said, these fish are eating the flies more than we think. We have to set the hook more. The other thing is your position. Let's say you're nymphing and you're casting to your left and the current's going from left to right. You make your cast, make your mends, and by the time that gets to about 12:30 on the clock face, if 12 is right across from you, you've got to be ready to set the hook. Your rod has to be down pointing at your indicator. If it's up in the air, it's a two-part hook set. If it's pointing right at your indicator, it's a straight pull. And you got to be quick. I use two hands to set it. It's the old accordion set. You haul with your left hand, and with your right hand, you go downstream, your casting hand, downstream. It's like playing the accordion. And that gets all your slack out of the line quickly, and you got to make contact with that fish. Plus, the downstream hook set is the best because generally you catch the corner of the mouth. If you're facing straight away and your flies are down to your right, and you go like you're making a back cast, you're lifting up to set the hook, you're pulling that fly right out of the fish's mouth. So if you go a low, side stream, downstream hook set, you're going to pull it into the corner of his mouth. And the corner of the mouth hook set very rarely gets off the fish, very rarely. You've got to break the line to get off. And you have to be very quick at that. And reflexes, I believe they can be learned. Most people don't have them because we work in offices, et cetera, et cetera. But once you get on the river, I've seen many people at the end of the day get very quick at setting that hook. You've got to be in the right position, rod low, and watch that indicator, you know, like it's $1 million floating by. You don't take your eyes off it because when you do, the fish know you're not looking, and then they eat, and you miss the strike. So the hook set has to be fast, not violent, fast.
Okay.
And any little movement of that indicator, I set the hook every time. If a bird flies over your head, I tell people, set the hook. If the indicator even thinks about moving, set that hook. Because you probably saw something subconsciously that was a fish that made that move.
All right. Yeah, I remember, you know, your point about having your rod pointed down at your indicator. I think at one of the fly fishing shows, which I know you've been a speaker at the fly fishing show in Denver, one of them, that was Lefty Gray, was in the casting pond. And he did a little quick demo, and that's all you had to do was see this once. He threw about a, you know, 40, 50-foot cast out there, and then he showed you the reaction time of if you were trying to set the hook and your rod was up versus down. And it was just amazing. Basically, the end of the line did not even move when the rod was up. But when the rod tip was down, pointed at the fly, it was immediate reaction at the end of the line. And I thought that was a great demo to show people what difference that makes in set of the hook. So anyway, illustrate that again, same point. So that's terrific.
He knows what he's talking about.
I guess so.
6 or 7 years old, he knows stuff.
Yeah, he knows stuff that we'll never know, probably.
Probably right.
Anyway, it's time to wrap things up. We're out of time here. But stick with me here, Michael. I've got some prizes to give away. And we're going to give away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and also that one-year subscription to Hook Now, the online magazine by Dave Hughes, Rick Kafley, and Skip Morris. So stick with us here, and we'll be doing those giveaways in just a few minutes. The Sacred Headwaters is a vast alpine basin in northern British Columbia where three of the greatest Canadian wild salmon rivers start, the Skeena, the Nass, and the Stikine. All begin their journeys to the Pacific Ocean there. Here adjacent, the renowned Batsitsi Wilderness, grizzly bears, stone sheep, and Osborne caribou exist in large numbers, and wild trout return each year to spawn. There are currently a two-year moratorium on coal bed methane development in the Sacred Headwaters imposed by the British Columbia government. There's less than 1 year remaining, and Royal Dutch Shell's subsidiary of Shell Canada have not changed their intent for a full industrialized coal bed methane project in the Sacred Headwaters. Sacred Headwaters is also rich in mineral and energy resources, including coal and coal bed methane, gas trapped in coal deposits. Royal Dutch Shell, through its subsidiary Shell Canada Energy, wants to turn the Sacred Headwaters into a coal methane gas field. If this plan goes ahead, the rich alpine ecosystem will be converted to an industrial landscape with thousands of gas wells connected to a maze of pipelines and roads. If you want to learn more about this and get involved and maybe help to stop this, you can go to www.SkeenaWatershed.com. That's S-K-E-E-N-A, SkeenaWatershed.com. So just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link, leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners from our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. And it's too late to register now, but be sure to do so for our next show because we're always giving away some great prizes, and I know you'd like to be the lucky winner. So the first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And you can find out more about the Federation if you'd like at fedflyfishers.org. And it's a great organization to support and be a member of, an international organization, not just trout, but saltwater fishing as well and warmwater fishing. So take a look. Anyway, our winner for that is Josh Huddle in Michigan, Josh Huddle. So congratulations, Josh. I know you'll enjoy your membership. If you do already have one, let us know and we'll get it extended for you. Now we'll give away that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And Fly Fusion is a magazine out of Calgary, Canada. You can find out more about them at flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. Great instructional, educational magazine with excellent photography. And our winner for that is Joe Herndon, Joe Herndon in Texas. So congratulations, Joe. I know you'll enjoy that subscription as well. Now we have to do our giveaway, and this is going to be that one-year subscription to Hook Now online e-zine published by Dave Hughes, Rick Hafley, and Skip Morris. Talking about icons in the industry, there's many books of knowledge between these three guys, so you can imagine what you're going to find on their website. So to win this subscription, you have to answer this question. Two-part question. Things we talked about, Michael and I talked about tonight, so Michael, I hope I ask these questions correctly, and you can tell me if we get the right answers here. This is the first question. Michael said there are three seasons that are better for streamer fishing. What are those three seasons? And Michael likes using a sow bug, and it has kind of an interesting name. What's that sow bug that he uses? What's the name of that sow bug? So those are the questions, and we'll see what they come up with here, Michael. I'm checking our incoming answers here and see if we got any players tonight that were paying attention. They're not the quickest typers. They kind of type like they set the hook, you know, a little slow. So
I look a little better than I type too, as well, Roger. Finger.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Okay, here we've got an answer. You tell me if this is correct, Michael. So for the seasons, he's got fall, spring, and winter. And for the sow bug, he has Ray Charles.
Exactly. Correct.
Exactly. So our first answer is our winner. That's Bill Hefner in Nazareth. I'm not sure where Nazareth is.
Nazareth, Pennsylvania. I know that.
Oh, really? Maybe that's where it is. So, Bill, you're the winner. Send me your... Actually, I have what I need. You already sent your email address, if that's correct. then that's all I need to get your subscription started with Hook Now, and we'll get that set up and get that going for you. So congrats, and thanks for playing, and thanks for paying attention. I really appreciate that. Well, Michael, I really appreciate you being on the show with us tonight, taking time out of your busy summer work schedule, because I know this is the time of the year that you do a lot of fishing, but I appreciate you taking time with us and sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you, Roger. I enjoyed it. We'll have to do it again sometime.
Yeah, and have to, like you said, go fishing with each other sometime. So, and to make a trip up there maybe in the fall sometime. Well, hopefully all of you have found the archive on our website. If you haven't yet, there are a couple of links on it on our homepage and links at the bottom of every page. In the archive, you're going to find all of our past shows, over 150 now. And you can search by a keyword or keyword phrases like trout, tarpon, Madison River, Bighorn River, whatever you'd like, and explore the archive. You'll be pleasantly surprised to think about all the shows that we have there and what you'll discover there. Our next broadcast will be on August 22nd, and on that show, we're going to be interviewing Dave Whitlock, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing art and illustration. A little different show this time. Dave Whitlock has been creating fly fishing fine art paintings and illustrating his books and articles for most of his life. Not only is he a great artist, but an incredible fisherman. So listen in to find out how Dave got started, how he creates, and how he sells his artwork, and how it plays into his fishing life. It should be quite interesting, and Dave is always a pleasure to interview. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Flats Time Charters, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. And don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.